We'll proceed next in the matter of Christine H. versus Lisa R. Hearing first from Ms. Amato.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Honey Kessler Amato, and I am counsel for appellant and petitioner Christine H. I'd like to briefly highlight the facts of this case to distinguish it from the cases we've heard earlier this morning. With regard to the child who was born to Christine H., it was Christine H.'s intention to have a child, whether or not she was in a relationship, and whether or not she was in a relationship with Lisa R. And indeed, she underwent artificial insemination to have that child, indeed with the support of Lisa. Late in the pregnancy, the parties entered into a stipulation and a pre-birth judgment by which Lisa was named as the second parent of the unborn child. But the record shows that Christine did not intend by that judgment to give up her rights as parent or even to share her rights as parent. Her intent was not adoptive. In fact, the record shows she had three goals for entering into the pre-birth judgment. One was testamentary. She wanted Lisa to have her child if anything happened to her. The second was to preclude the father, Kenneth C., from having any parental rights. He was not protected by 7613B, having not gone through a doctor and being a known donor. And the third reason that she entered into the agreement was to secure health insurance for her child. With that, I would turn to the issues that have been raised by this court and start with that the pre-birth judgment has no legal effect in this case. First of all, the pre-birth judgment is fatally flawed as an adoption. An adoption in our state requires at least three things. One is informed consent, that one is sharing or giving up a part of their parental rights or, in fact, turning over their parental rights. But in this case, of course, it would have been a sharing.
This court have to reach the substantive issue of the validity of the judgment, an issue you just raised. If this court were to conclude that Christine is stopped from challenging the validity of that judgment?
If this court concludes that she is stopped from challenging the validity of the judgment, then one would have to look at whether or not that judgment was valid in its application in that. There was no hearing as to whether or not she understood her constitutional rights and whether or not she understood what rights she was giving up. So the question would be, if you hold that the judgment is valid, was the judgment a breach of her constitutional rights and in the court even entering into this judgment?
Now, Christine was the plaintiff in the, over here. Christine was the,
thank you.
Christine was the plaintiff, wasn't she, in the initial complaint?
Yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't that sort of assume that she knows her rights? And
not necessarily at all, Your Honor. The record shows that they went to, the couple went together, Christine and Lisa went to attorneys late in the pregnancy. There's nothing that shows in this record whether or not her attorneys explained her rights. And ironically, they were speaking in terms of surrogacy contracts. And in the contract that they signed with their attorney, it also says that these pre-birth judgments are new, the whole area of the law is undeveloped. So there's nothing that shows that she understood her rights. And critically on that point, when the court entered the judgment, there was no hearing of any kind. The record is very clear on that. There was no inquiry into whether or not Christine knew what her rights were and that she was going to be giving them up. And conversely, that Lisa understood what she would have been undertaking under this judgment.
And they lived for 2 years under the auspices of the stipulated judgment?
They lived for 23 months, that's correct, Your Honor.
And this is a 10-year relationship?
Yes, Your Honor. So going on with my point about that the judgment is invalid, that I would believe the judgment is invalid, and I would invite the court to reach, of course, that issue first, because it does. The third element that I was going to address with regard to adoptions is the need for a home study. And none of the elements here.
I may have misunderstood you. I thought that if this court were to hold that the doctrine of estoppel is applicable here, then there is certainly no need whatsoever for this court to reach the issue that you would like to raise, and that is the validity of the judgment. And as you know, the doctrine of estoppel is ordinarily relied upon to prevent a party from contesting the validity of a judgment that that party itself has procured. And this is to follow up on the question that Justice Moreno asked. Wasn't your client the party involved in seeking this particular judgment that you now say is absolutely invalid?
My client was indeed involved with securing this judgment, Your Honor. However, and I do think the court should reach the question of whether it's valid, parties cannot enter into agreements that preclude the courts from looking out for the best interests of the children. Parties cannot enter into agreements by which they transfer parental rights or have people create children for them. The idea of adoption is to protect children. If this court, in fact, finds that this pre-birth judgment is valid, even though the parties entered into it, even though Christine H. did indeed enter into the judgment and was a plaintiff, then what the court is inviting people to do is completely bypass adoptions.
Well, you seem to be suggesting that upholding that stipulated judgment would go contrary to the policy of securing the best interests of the child. But why is it if two parties stipulate that they are parents, and that gives the child two parents instead of one, why is it that it's in effect against public policy for the court to recognize that stipulation which confers recognition of being two parents?
Your Honor, I'd like to answer what I understand to be a two-part question as to why it would be against public policy for this judgment and why would it be against public policy not to find two parents. The first is it would be against public policy to enter this judgment, because this judgment really is an end play about around adoption. Lisa herself argued that this is a faster remedy than adoption, and it's cheaper. And that's not what the judiciary should be concerned about in terms of creating parental rights. The second question with regard to why not have two parents, it is correct that the statutes talk in terms of being interested in having two parents and that it being a goal to have two parents. But that policy comes directly against an equal policy in our state that single women and single men can parent. Single women can parent certainly through artificial insemination, and perhaps men too through surrogates, and single people can adopt in our state.
They can, but there's no preference in favor of single parenting over double parenting.
There is no preference in favor of single parenting, but nor, Your Honor, should we say that because if one is a single parent, that they are vulnerable to the state finding that there's a presumed parent who is not biologically created, not biologically connected to that child, then being imposed on that single family, that single parent family. So,
in seeking the stipulated judgment that is at the heart of this case, were the parties represented by counsel?
They were both represented by the same counsel, yes.
And your argument is that your client had no idea what she was doing.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is my argument. She had an interest in, as indicated, in her three goals, which was testamentary, to cut off the rights of Kenneth C., which she couldn't do either by this judgment, and to secure health insurance, but that she did not understand that she was, in fact, sharing parental rights and diminishing her own exclusive parental rights.
You've said a couple of times that the court should determine whether this is invalid.
Yes.
Are you arguing that this judgment is void or voidable, or does that matter?
I'm actually arguing that it's ultimately void, and it's void because it is against public policy in that it doesn't follow adoptions. I would argue that it's also against public policy because it invites having private agreements for the creation of parental rights in children that are not biologically related, and that then invites creating those rights around adoption. I think critical to this analysis is that the state, that our state has an adoption plan, and that plan is to protect children, and that these judgments do not address the best interests of children.
How would you distinguish the procedures where family support divisions as they proceed with attempts to enforce support from fathers, routinely, I think pursuant to statute, get fathers to commit and declare that they are the father of the child needing support.
I would distinguish that, Your Honor, in that those declarations under the 7570 block of statutes, to sign a declaration, certainly the mother is asked to identify a biological father. And then there has to be a panoply of rights that are explained to the father and to the mother in that she's identifying somebody and what's the consequences of that, and that those declarations include the explanation of rights and obligations, the very thing that is absent from the process that we followed. And therefore, the pre-birth judgment could not operate as those declarations do, as a declaration of maternity based on the declaration of paternity statutes.
But doesn't the Uniform Parentage Act under, 7630B provide that any interested party may bring an action at any time for the purpose of determining the existence or non-existence of a father and child relationship, and it can be done before the child is born? Is it your position that doesn't apply to women?
No, Your Honor. My position is that that statute doesn't say when the judgment can be entered. That statute does say that they can bring an action before, but there's an open question as to when that can be entered. And since this pre-birth judgment tries to operate as a second parent adoption, you have to address best interest, and you can't address best interest before the child's born, because then you're addressing it in the abstract, and that's not addressing the needs of the child.
Is there some public policy for not addressing it before the child is born?
No public policy that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but the practicality. That is, we can talk in generalities about the best interests of a child who's to be born, but until the child's born, we don't know what the needs of that child or the reality of that child. So I would say the practicality is, although I can't direct your attention to a public policy, but the practicalities are that judgment that looks at best interests requires the child.
Does the UPA provide for the determination of parentage of an unborn child with respect to a person who is not alleged to be biologically related?
Not that I'm aware of. You're asking me if the UPA provides for...
The words. Justice Chin was just saying you can determine the parentage of an unborn child. But can you do that with respect to someone who alleges no biological relation? Because you don't have the holding out at that point.
Right.
What would be the basis of it?
I would think, Your Honor, that with regard to a child who's unrelated, the UPA would speak in terms of children of a marriage, either the presumption of the marriage or that the child is born of the marriage under 7540 or under 7611 A through C, that there's a marriage. And I think that's the only grounds that we have before the child is born.
Well, we just heard in the last argument that we should pay attention to what the people did at the beginning and not how they acted after they entered into the agreement. Now you're telling us that we shouldn't pay attention to the agreement.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's why this court has all three cases, because it does give you many permutations to look at all these different facts. I would agree with those counsel that have said be careful about looking at looking at subjective factors, because subjective factors will invite every trial court to weigh them differently and to come up with different results. And in fact, this court itself made that observation in State of Ford and said that when it comes to adoption, you're not going to look at the subjective components, because it does lead to subjective findings in an area that needs bright light.
Do you see a difference between agreements that are negotiated, that are stipulated to, and, on the other hand, a form that might be thrust upon parties as a condition for their entering into actions?
I think that an agreement that is negotiated, one would assume that that agreement then reflects their understanding. With regard to a form that's perhaps a boilerplate form, there would be, the question would be a factual question as to what they understood that they were entering into. The same as here. Christine is saying she didn't understand what she was entering into, and her form was...
Even though she was, in effect, a plaintiff who went to court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Represented by counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. And herein, I think we, as counsel, we attorneys, in this part of our judiciary system, we attorneys, need to be very careful what we guide counsel, what we guide our clients, what we think is creative, and that what we create to get around procedures that have been established. Yes,
but of course, we are limited to the record before us, and in response to the Chief's question, you would want us to consider facts that, at least in my view, are not before us, that your client had no idea what she was getting into. And as the Chief pointed out, here it was your client who, and earlier Justice Moreno pointed this out, your client was the plaintiff in filing an action in Superior Court labeled complaint to declare existence of parental rights. Then, as has been indicated several times by the bench, here your client was represented by counsel, and yet you want us to hold or conclude that, well, your client simply didn't know what she was doing. Again, unless you can point to anything before the record, before us, that's not shown in the record. Apart from the stipulated judgment, which says that your client is the biological, genetic, and legal mother slash parent of the unborn child, and there is an agreement to joint custody with the partner, Lisa, etc., etc. Then the judgment goes on to say that your client and the partner, Lisa, are the only legally recognized parents of the unborn child and take full and complete legal custodial and financial responsibility of the child. Apart from that, the child then was born in October of 2000. Her surname consisted of hyphenating your client's and her partner's surnames. And I thought there was something else that I wanted to ask you about, but I don't have it in front of me. But given, and again, you have responded to your disagreement with the validity of the judgment, but given that judgment, which in express language states that Christine assumes, willingly assumes, the parental relationship, and given the fact that the child that was then born was given a surname that was a combination of both your client and her partner, why shouldn't the doctrine of estoppel be applicable here?
Your Honor, before I answer the last question with regard to estoppel, I'd like to address a couple of the other points that that you raised in the question. One is, I'd like to clarify for the court that this record has no findings. This record has the judgment, but the court made, in the motion to set aside, the court made no factual findings. The record does include Christine's declarations as to what her intention was with regard to the judgment. There were no factual findings, though, but so it is in the record what her intentions were. The language the court read with regard to that the Christine and Lisa would be the only recognized parents was actually, excuse me, Your Honors, was actually language directed to preclude Kenneth C. from asserting any parental rights. And this judgment, without question, could not operate to terminate Kenneth C.'s rights. Kenneth C. was the donor. He went. The parties contracted together, Lisa and Kenneth, excuse me, Christine and Kenneth contracted directly, and therefore Kenneth C. has none of the protective wall of 7613B, and I think it would be beyond debate that his rights could not be cut off by this judgment. With regard to the question of estoppel, Your Honor, estoppel would go certainly to what the intent of the parties were. Amongst the things that we don't know is what was the actual intent of these parties. Christine tells us that her intent was not adoptive. The fact that they shared surnames would be, again, the subjective kind of indicia that this court should be careful to avoid, because, again, you will be creating parental rights outside of statute and outside of adoption, and that is something that we need to tread upon very, very carefully. If there's no further questions about the judgment, I would like to turn to 7611D. With regard to 7611D, I would argue on behalf of Christine that 7611D does not apply to same-sex couples and does not apply in this case. First of all, 7611D is a fiction, and it applies to resolve questions of paternity. 7611A through C do not apply as they involve marriage, and I think was referenced in one of the earlier arguments. But 7611D applies to unmarried biological fathers. The statute reads that a man will be deemed to be the father, and this has come up, of course, earlier, the language being the critical language, he receives the child into his home and openly holds the child out as his natural child. If we attempt to interpret 7611D in a gender-neutral fashion, then, in effect, it still would not apply to the facts at bar, because we know who the natural mother is. And this court told us in Johnson versus Calvert that 7611D does not apply to mothers because we know either biologically who they are or we know what their respective claims are, the basis of their respective claims. Significantly, the rules of statutory construction preclude us from reading 7611D to apply to mothers, to maternity. The first rule of statutory construction is that we have to define the terms of the statute. The statute reads that one holds out one's natural child, and natural has been defined in case law as biological.
Ms. Amato, as you know, we have in the previous cases raised the issue of the legislative policy to have two parents for a child. If we were to agree with you, obviously the child would have one parent, and underlying the policy of having two parents is the recognition that when you have two parents, there is greater emotional and financial support. And again, if we were to agree with you, wouldn't that run counter to California's implicit or express legislative policy?
Your Honor, it would go against that policy of desiring two parents, but it would be consistent with California's recognition that a single woman can be a mother and can be a family unit, and that a single man can be a single parent family unit. And those family units are entitled to respect as well. In 7613B, the artificial insemination statute, it speaks of a single woman becoming inseminated. The Uniform Act spoke only of a married woman becoming inseminated, and California expressly rejected that in deference to allowing single people to become families.
So,
Justice, can I go ahead and ask the last question?
In your view, it's a case-by-case evaluation?
Your Honor, no, I'm actually looking for bright lines, but I'm not sure what you mean by a case-by-case evaluation. I hate to have my last question both be ambiguous and not answer it clearly. Your Honor, I would be delighted to answer if I understood the question.
But your viewpoint is, no, you don't have to look at it case-by-case. From your standpoint, it's not that difficult a case, and we can establish a bright line.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, and since it's my last question, Your Honor, what I'm saying is, yes, we do have a policy of looking to two parents, but we equally have single parent families. And those two things obviously come up against each other, and we need to respect the single parent family and not just say because it's a single family and we prefer two parents, we will impose a non-biological parent on the family. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Amato. You're
welcome.
Now from Ms. Shearer.
May it please the Court. I'd like to go back to Justice Kennard's comment about the record, because the record, in addition to the clear language of the stipulation and judgment, also includes the clear language of the declaration that Christine filed in her motion to set aside the judgment, in which she alleged that the only reason to set it aside was because it was entered pre-birth. And she says two things in that declaration. She says, one, she never intended to surrender all of her parental rights, which, of course, she did not do. And she says the only reason that she's bringing the motion to vacate the judgment is because she's afraid that sometime further on down the line, someone will question the validity of this judgment because it was entered pre-birth. None of these second guessings or uncertainties that counsel has advanced in her briefs turn up anywhere in the record, including the record at the moment in time when Christine had a complete change of heart and, represented by counsel, filed declarations stating her state of mind for the court. So speculations about she didn't understand what she was doing are not just contradicted by the language of the judgment establishing Lisa's parental rights, but by her own subsequent declaration when she's trying to avoid the effects of that judgment. I don't think that argument takes us anywhere. Next, I wanted to go back to the concept of natural parent, because this court correctly held in Johnson and Calvert that natural is a euphemism to replace legitimate. And that, in fact, when you look at the comment, not Cal-UPA, but the original UPA, to that section, so they were trying to avoid the prior language. The filiation proceedings, legitimacy proceedings, had all been about classifying kids as legitimate or illegitimate. So they used the term natural to mean legal parent, and subsequently in Bazanka, the Fourth District picked up this court's holding in Johnson versus Calvert that natural does not mean biological, and held that natural didn't mean biological for either John Bazanka or, I'm blanking on her name, Mrs. Luann Bazanka. In JC's case, even though none of them had a biological connection, natural is a term of art in Cal-UPA, and it was a way to work out the problem of disposing of the old language following the constitutional mandate, which is the way we need to read Cal-UPA, that all children be treated equally, regardless of whether their parents participate in the formalities of marriage, domestic partnership, or adoption. The U.S. Supreme Court had mandated that parental conduct in terms of these formalities that Ms. Amato argues should be the stepping stone for children to have rights to their relationship with their parents were treated as unconstitutional differentiations between classes of children. That's what led California and the other states to adopt the UPA, so that we wouldn't have all these kids falling between the cracks because their parents didn't do things according to Hoyle. We can't have a bright line test that protects children, because children can't control the pre-birth conduct or the post-birth conduct, for that matter, of their parents. And the purpose of the UPA is to treat all children and all children's rights to their relationships with both of their parents equally. We must interpret the statute with reference to the Constitution, because this is a statute that only exists because of the Constitution. We cannot avoid the constitutional questions whenever we look at Cal-UPA, because it's a statute that came into existence to fulfill a constitutional mandate.
Here, the judgment that we've been talking about was filed in Superior Court in September of 2000. The child was born October of 2000, and I gather the parties separated in September of 2002. Is that correct?
That's correct, and they shared custody for the following year. After they were separated, they continued to co-parent.
Is there anything in the record to show that at the time of separation, when the child was just about 2 years old, Christine had cared for her exclusively?
No, the record, quite to the contrary, contains Lisa's declaration, the declarations of family, friends, and others, showing that the parents had co-parented equally.
What is your response to counsel's argument that the stipulation, in effect, is just an in run around adoption?
We don't require adoption as the only means by which heterosexuals who use assisted reproduction become the parents of their own children. Adoption is not intended for that purpose. It's been a makeshift remedy that same-sex couples have used because the laws have denied them the remedies available to the rest of the population for establishing parentage at birth. Adoption, especially second parent adoption, was intended really for two circumstances. One, when a couple entered into a relationship where one of the partners had a prior child, like a step-parent adoption, and the other is where a same-sex couple decided to adopt jointly a child that they obtained from an adoption agency or through an independent adoption. It was not intended for a couple exercising their procreative conduct and making a decision to form a family in which one of them bore the child or they used a surrogate or other means of assisted reproduction to have their parentage recognized. It's a second best choice. So we have a situation where if Lisa had been Lester, she could have signed a voluntary declaration of paternity in the hospital. No one would have scrutinized whether or not she was in fact a biological parent, and it would be entitled after 2 years to the same weight as a judgment. But because the hospitals only issue those to men and not to women, she was forced to follow this other procedure.
Now, there is a biological male involved in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And but he's not involved in this litigation.
That's also correct.
And there's been no judgment terminating his parenthood.
No, there's been no judgment terminating his parenthood. There's been no litigation to which he's been a party.
And if we assume the judgment in this case is valid, which that's your assertion, I take it, then what happens if and when the biological male asserts his rights, or let's say the county proceeds against that individual for support?
Well, he has no standing under Dawn D, since he's established no relationship with the child. He's a mere biological parent, number
but
one.
His rights haven't been litigated. We don't know, other than what's being said in cases, that he's not a party to.
He's signed a sperm donor agreement indicating that he relinquished all his rights, which is part of the record. And he's not manifested himself now in the child's life, and she's almost 5 years old. I don't think that that's a serious concern that we have at this point. And should he appear, he's not taken her into his home. He's not.
He doesn't have the statutory immunity through the anonymous sperm donor statute, does he?
I would not concede that point. I think that, when I look at 7613, I look at two things. First of all, I look at the comment that the drafters of the Uniform Act made, that they did not intend through 7613 to address all of the many and complicated facts of assisted reproduction. And I look at the history of this court and others in applying what I call the assisted reproduction statute by parity of reasoning to cases that don't literally fall within it. And I note that if we look at the statute again, from the constitutional perspective of protecting the child's interests, the child has no interest in whether or not her parents go do the insemination in a physician's office or not. The physician's office requirement, historically, if we look at the history of artificial insemination, was because people viewed artificial insemination as a form of adultery. And it was believed that if you did the if you medicalized this and made it a medical procedure, you put some distance between the donor and the recipient of the donation, that you could get rid of the stigma of adultery. But there's no public policy served by requiring people to only go through physicians. And in fact, we cited in the brief a number of the obstacles that are faced by same-sex couples when they try to use physicians for insemination. It's not always easy, and they're not always cooperative. And there's no nexus between the medical condition and the child's well-being. So I think that the court probably should, by at least parity of reasoning, say that a donor who knowingly donates with his or her genetic material with the clear and manifested intention not to be a parent, and who subsequently doesn't acquire parental rights by conduct, as one would if one took one's child into one's home under 7611D, or one married the other parent under the earlier parts of 7611 ABC, if you don't do that, you're out of the ballpark, even if you don't fall within the literal language of
that. But you'd have to agree, I believe, that since that individual has never been a party to any of this litigation, and has never had the opportunity to present his version of what may have happened, that any judgment that's entered into here would not affect his rights or obligations, would it?
I'd be happy to brief that. There are, just from recall, but without seeing her thumbing through the code, I recall a variety of sections in the parentage sections of the family code which say that you can defeat a subsequent action for parentage by a prior judgment of parentage establishing it in another party. My own practice...
Even if you're not aware of it?
Yes. My own practice in these cases is to always join every possible person who, if we know their identity, so that we don't have that problem. Counsel,
I guess
here
my concern is whether, you know, we certainly have to respect the legislature's policy of up to two parents for a family. And so that's the reason I raised this issue about this third individual who is not part of this litigation.
We look at the court's opinion in Jesusa, where they're comparing the biological and the marital father, each of whom had actual relationships, and we get it should such a father emerge, and we were to do a 76-12 balancing, assuming that we first found it was an appropriate case to do that balancing, which is another hurdle. This probably would not be an appropriate case when someone waits till the child is five, has no contact with her, sees a judgment establishing someone else as the parent and then comes forward. That would be pretty startling. But even assuming we got over that hurdle, in any balancing between the role that the sperm donor, who waived any rights he had at the time of the donation and vanished from the kid's life thereafter, as compared to Lisa, who has, since before this child's conception and up to this very day, acted in every way the same way that a husband would whose wife was artificially inseminated. I don't think, you know, that we have a serious question in this case. As a matter of practice pointers for family lawyers, I think it's extraordinarily foolhardy not to join and adjudicate the non-parentage of any possible contender for the role of parent. But when I reread yesterday all of the cases cited in our briefs, and as I was rereading them, I was struck by how many cases had an absent biological parent who was not a party, and there was the non-participation of those absent dads was never a barrier to either the lower courts or this court finding the people before them were parents. I don't think it should be so here. I think it was sloppy lawyering, but I don't think it's a bar to Lauren's right to have her real-world relationships with both of her moms, her mom and her mommy, protected by this court. And that's what we're really here about. We're here about Lauren's rights, Lauren's relationships,
and
Lauren's
needs. What's your position as far as estoppel argument?
I believe that Christine's course of conduct gives rise to a clear estoppel. I think no different than the conduct in Sorensen and no different than John Bazanka's conduct. These were both situations in which the decision to have a child was made within a unitary family, was made jointly, was made with the clear intention that they both be parents. And I also note that the law of Sorensen, which antedates by about 5 years, Cal-UPA, didn't require 7613 to find that the donor was not a dad and that Mr. Sorensen was a dad. We have a vital common law tradition here in California, and we have many sections of our family code that were adopted long before Cal-UPA, and those continue in full force and effect. Cal-UPA did not supersede the prior law, it augmented it.
And would it cut both ways?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. If Lisa was trying to avoid responsibility for Lauren, it would clearly cut both ways. There's no question about that.
So your view is that in this particular case, it would be unfair to Lisa and the child to allow Christine to challenge the validity of the judgment after seeking the judgment, the stipulated judgment at issue, and living under the benefits of that judgment willingly and voluntarily for 2 years.
Absolutely. After, even before that, after conception, after the point where the two of them, the Court of Appeal opinion very beautifully describes this joint course of conduct that this family, this couple, not two random individuals who entered into a commercial transaction that was a contract, but a family of two people who wanted to become parents together, engaged into to cause the conception of this child. Once they conceived their child, the stipulation, the judgment, were merely the formalizing of that intent. And I was interested in Ms. Amato's argument that her client wanted part of the bargain but not the whole thing. She wanted testamentary rights and to get rid of the donor and to secure health insurance. But so she wanted all the benefits of the bargain but none of the burdens.
Before you run out of your time, which will be pretty soon, throughout each of the preceding cases, I'm sure you may have picked up the fact that the court was quite concerned with the public policy at issue. And to refresh your memory, we've been talking about the legislative public policy as to the importance, as much as possible, to give a child to parents. How would that policy be affected here if we were to agree with you?
It would protect Lauren's right to two parents, the two parents that she's known since the day she came into the world, and that she'll, when her parents go home to her today under the existing parenting plan that the court's ordered, she continues to enjoy. If this court ruled otherwise, Lauren would suffer what one mental health professional has publicly termed a parentectomy. She would lose one of her primary attachment figures. It would have grave and profound consequences for her psychological development, as Amiki have briefed. It would, Lisa was, in fact, in this family, the primary breadwinner, and it would put her economic her economic well-being in jeopardy. And in the event, as happened in some of the LA Times a few months ago, actually about 6 months ago, I think it was, ran a story about what happened to the children in Curial v. Reagan and the other same-sex cases where the first and third district chopped off these relationships. And this was one set of sad stories. Kids had serious long-term psychological problems, and one of them, the legal mother, died, and the kid finally ended up back with the other mother. We know from those stories what happens to children when we give them a parentectomy at age 4 or 5 or 2. And we know that parents get sick, parents pass away, parents aren't always there for the long run. So having two parents is also a safety net for children. In the event of the death or disability of one, the child has two strong attached relationships and someone who continues to be responsible for their well-being.
I think you answered my earlier question about adoption by saying that it wasn't appropriate to impose that where it's a same-sex couple and they're talking about parenting their own children, essentially. But my question is, if we were to agree with you, it wouldn't be limited, I assume, to same-sex couples. And so basically, there would be a question as to why you would ever adopt if you could simply enter into this stipulation.
You adopt when you're adopting. Heterosexual couples do not use adoption to confirm their parentage when one of them uses artificial insemination. Heterosexual couples don't use adoption when one of them has an egg donation. They just list themselves on the birth certificate as mom and dad, and no one ever contests it. The issue only arises for same-sex couples because of the social barriers and the historical barrier and the series of first and third district opinions which fail to recognize these families. Adoption was not intended for that purpose. It was imported as a makeshift to provide what protection could be provided under the circumstances in the absence of clear holdings from this court or legislation that instead of throwing gender neutral into a separate section was actually written in terms of parents rather than moms and dads, so that we could have that clarity. It would not meet the constitutional obligation to treat all children equally, regardless of marital status and formalities, if we said that the children of heterosexual couples are already their parents' kids, but the children of same-sex couples are only their parents' kids if they go through the extra step of adoption.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I'm actually trying to get at something a little bit different, which is the ability to sort of manipulate this by people who are actually unrelated biologically to the children and who would nevertheless avoid adoption. And so that
who would want to do that? I've been practicing for almost 30 years. I only do family law. I only do custody and parentage. I have never seen someone come into my office and say, I want to accept legal and financial responsibility for the child of a stranger because I don't want to raise this kid. It doesn't happen. We don't have to worry about it. It's an imagined boogeyman. People don't do that.
Well, for instance, could a man and a pregnant woman enter into a stipulated judgment of non-paternity, let's say?
Although your time is up, you may respond.
That would, it would be subject to scrutiny based on the child's best interests. I don't think they could where he was where the woman was already pregnant. Yeah, they do all that. I mean, if you look at the Charlie Chaplin case, which I cited, and the Flip Wilson case, both of those were pre-birth proceedings, in fact, where such stipulations were upheld. So historically in California, that has been the case going back, you know, a generation now. But sometimes those are set aside, where they're not in the child's interest, where they're clearly a fiction. So if you had someone who was a biological father, and there was no one else on the scene who is going to be a presumed father, like a new partner, then perhaps you could have that result.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Chair. Here now from Mr. Minter.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Shannon Minter, on behalf of several amici who filed in support of LASA. I did just want to call the court's attention to the fact that the record in this case would reflect that the sperm donor here did file a declaration opposing the motion to set aside the judgment. But I realize that this court has to deal with the whole broad range of possible circumstances. And if that was not the circumstance, I think the donor is the only person who would possibly have standing to try and vacate this order. In that case, as my co-counsel indicated, courts would simply apply the very same rules they would apply if it was a married couple using a known donor where they didn't or appeared not to comply with the physician supervision requirement, and the court would have to sort out those competing claims and find which were the two legal parents. Your Honor, we think the Court of Appeal decision was very impressive in its analysis of the 7611D issue here and its gender-neutral approach to construing that statute. Were distressed by the exclusive reliance on 7611D to deal with the parentage of children who are born to unmarried couples through assisted reproduction. It leaves those children unprotected. It creates a very severe disparity between them and similarly situated children of married couples. And I think it's important that the court be aware that if this court were to reject the propriety of couples obtaining judgments both pre- and post-birth in this situation, it would be a departure from existing practice. There are hundreds, at least, of trial court decisions granting parentage decrees very much like this one, mostly for same-sex couples, increasingly also for some unmarried heterosexual couples, and as well for married couples who, where there's any question when they've used assisted reproduction about who the two legal parents are. And I would call the court's attention to a new provision in the Family Code, 7648.9, just enacted last year. This doesn't specifically address pre-birth judgments, but it does indicate that it's not possible for someone to try and set aside a parentage judgment based on under 7613 or on a surrogacy agreement based on asserting non-biology, that you don't have a biological connection to the child. So I do think that gives us some indication of where the legislature is leaning on judgments involving artificial insemination and surrogacy, that they would like them to be upheld, and it's probably relevant to the court's analysis here. If the law does not permit an early, clear determination at birth of who a child's parents are, if we don't know when a child is born who are the parents, it does leave that child terribly unprotected. It's important for health insurance reasons, medical decision-making. If something happens to either of the parents, I don't think I need to spell that out. It also creates a really stark disparity if children of married parents under 7613 automatically have two legal parents. Children who are born under exactly the same circumstances to an unmarried couple can only have one parent unless they adopt. my co-counsel suggested, there really is no reason in policy or in the statute to assume that adoption should be the default model for children born to unmarried couples through assisted reproduction. You look at 7613, the purpose of that statute, there is nothing about the marital status of the parties that is relevant to the purpose of the statute or to this court's analysis and application of that statute in other cases. The court is not focused on the marital status of the party or the relationship between the two adults, but whether there is a joint intention on their part to parent.
Do you share the view of Ms. Scheer that in this particular case the doctrine of estoppel applies?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I think just under black letter law, Christine would at this point be equitably estopped and judicially estopped from contesting the prior judgment.
In a brief, in an amicus brief filed by Legal Services of, for Children, there is the assertion that there are hundreds of judgments similar to the one at issue here. If we were to agree with the opposing view, in your view, would that leave subject to attack the hundreds of similar judgments that are out there?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court agreed with Christine's position that that judgment can be attacked because it's void, then absolutely all of those other judgments would be equally vulnerable.
And if this court were to apply the doctrine of estoppel, in your view, would that give rise to a far lesser chance of attack on the validity of the judgments?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that would significantly minimize similarly situated litigants' ability to go back and try and contest those judgments. However, even that degree of putting those judgments in vulnerability is a frightening thought for those families. And I would hate to see, in our view, this couple did exactly what they should have done. They decided to have a child together, went through a very extensive process of planning, selecting donor, going through the medical procedures. It seems like we want to encourage people in that circumstance to go to court and get a judgment and clarify from the outset that we are this child's two legal parents, and I would hate to see that discouraged by the court. Part of what the court has to grapple with here, obviously, is whether 7613 can be applied outside of marriage, since the statute does use the words husband and wife. I think it has to be read, as has been noted, in conjunction with 7602 and 7650, which tell the court that the statute has to be read not to discriminate on the basis of marital status or on the basis of gender. I think what's really going on here is that when the legislature enacted the UPA back in the mid-70s, they were not specifically thinking about unmarried couples using assisted reproduction. This, the fact that they specifically address the use of AI by married couples does not, I think, reasonably imply any kind of legislative disapproval of extending that same rule in the statute to the use of AI by unmarried couples. There was a suggestion, I think, that there's something disturbing about allowing people who are not legally related to one another to make use of this statute. But I think we have to remember that the fact that a couple is not married or registered as domestic partners doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the degree of their commitment to parenting together. And I did want to remind the court, this was in one of the amici briefs, that of the approximately 100,000 same-sex couples in California, right now less than a third are registered as domestic partners. So we know for a fact, just as many unmarried couples have children outside of marriage, a third of all births by heterosexual couples are now outside of marriage. There will continue to be many children born to same-sex couples who are not registered. These couples are primarily using assisted reproduction to create their families. So going forward, we're talking about a large class of people. The very premise of the UPA as well is that every single child parentage should be established, and where possible, every child should be given two parents. It seems very anomalous and contrary to that core purpose to say that this one group of children, children who are born through assisted reproduction to unmarried couples, we can't determine their parentage. There must be an adoption in order for those children to have their parentage established and in order to gain two legal parents. I don't think that's consistent with the statute or with all the public policies that have been referenced here quite a bit.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Minter. Your time is up.
Thank you very much.
And we'll hear now from Ms. Amato by way of rebuttal.
Yes, thank you very much, Your Honor. I'd like to start by saying that adoption is not at all a makeshift remedy. Adoption is what confirms a parent's rights and how we transfer rights. And this court certainly said in Sharon S. that same-sex couples have adoption available to them, and we know that step-parents, in fact, inside of marriage, people confirm their rights through adoption, step-parent adoption. With regard to 7613, and speaking to the question of what the intention of the statute is, the intention was to stop partners either in marriage, for the child arising, the child is presumed to be a child of the marriage, or under the new legislation, that the child of registered domestic partners are presumed to be a child of that registered partnership. But with regard to single people who do not have an established relationship, if they choose to go through artificial insemination and, in fact, they are not married, if we had a man in the same situation as I think Justice Baxter, you had asked in an earlier case, that man would have no rights. And Duncan versus Bosky tells us that under 7611D, he would not be a biological father. He's not the father. He's not the presumed father because there's no marital relationship and he's not biologically related. So, in fact, the legislature has attempted to answer the many permutations of our state by creating rights both for marriage, for children who are born to married couples through artificial insemination, and to children who are born to domestic registered partners. With regard to Jesus V told us that when you have competing presumed parents, you can look to the various competing factors and what's in the child's best interest. But Jesus V was saying that 7612 looks to the competing parents under 7611. Jesus V tells us that 7612 does not put a presumed parent on equal footing with a biological parent. The psychological issues and the social theory that was raised in the amici briefs are important issues, and they are issues that need to be weighed, and that's why the question of whether or not we should have new procedures for creating parents or new definition of parents, having a presumed parent arising when there's no biological connection, those questions belong to the legislature. It's with the legislature that can contemplate the various psychological theories, the various social theories,
Nicholas, didn't we resolve the question that one can become a presumed parent even if one doesn't have a biological relationship?
Your Honor, thank you so much for raising Nicholas D. This court said in Nicholas D. that in a dependency case, a man could be determined to be the father without a biological connection. And I think that was a wise decision, and I think it was a compassionate decision, because otherwise it would have left this child parentless. And indeed, the courts of appeal followed suit in dependency cases and said that a woman not biologically connected can be deemed to be a mother. And this court needs to clarify for the bar and for the bench whether or not Nicholas D. has any application outside of dependency. Because indeed, outside of dependency and in this case and similarly placed cases, the child is not left parentless. This child has a mother. She has a biological mother, and that biological mother has the right to knowingly consent to sharing her rights with another person. And I would submit that here there's no knowing, and this child is not left parentless. So Nicholas D. calls out for clarification. We saw that a week to 10 days ago, the Sixth District entered a decision, Liebers versus Black, and said that a not biologically related man could be deemed to be a father, applying Nicholas D. And again, it invites this court to clarify, should 7611D in a non-biologically related, especially when the statute speaks of biology, whether or not it applies outside of dependency. I would also say, Your Honors, that the footnote in Johnson, in your case, Johnson versus Calvert, when this court said that the language of the statute, 7611D, which speaks of biology, wasn't really helpful in Johnson because you had the biological function divided between two women, the egg donor and the gestational mother, but this court was certainly not saying that biology doesn't matter, because it does matter, both in 7611D and in having constitutional rights that flow from biology.
Isn't it a neutral fact?
Biology?
Yes.
Not under the statute, Your Honor. It's not neutral, because under 7611D it speaks of natural. And if we're to read the statute, the word natural out of the statute, then we are violating rules of statutory construction. There's no reason to read it out, especially because there are remedies to protect the rights of non-biologically related partners. We have adoption, and ultimately, Your Honors, if not creating custodial rights through adoption, there is visitation that can be given to interested parties through the interested party visitation statutes.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Amato.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Chair, Mr. Minter. The matter stands submitted. We are in recess until 1:30.